Hey, you're listening to Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. Since the COVID-19 vaccine rollout began, media outlets, analysts, and journalists that identify as progressive, both in the mainstream and in independent media, have framed their criticisms of this controversial vaccination campaign and the big pharma profiteering there within, largely around concerns about vaccine inequity in the global South. To these voices, frequently seen featured in outlets such as Democracy Now!, Jacobin, and Common Dreams, among other progressive sites, the criticism is more or less like this: the chief manifestation of Big Pharma's corruption in the context of COVID-19 vaccines is their lack of vaccine sales to the global South, with those populations being eager for vaccines if only they were made significantly more affordable and available. Oddly, other forms of profiteering by Big Pharma related to this vaccination campaign, the role of the military in the vaccination campaign, and also blatant corruption within the FDA and NIH, are more often than not, treated as illegitimate criticisms by outlets that would normally pounce on the opportunity to expose corporate capture of regulatory agencies and all manifestations of the corporate profit motive, or perhaps another industry like oil and gas, for example. However, as myself and my guest today will be discussing, vaccine inequity is really a much smaller issue than a lot of these outlets and journalists have suggested. While the claim does remain a safe take, friendly to left-leaning sensibilities, even official sources have been forced to note in recent days that vaccine supply issues are hardly the main cause of low vaccine uptake on the African continent specifically, as there is a documented minimal interest in the vaccines from the continent's population, including a majority of its healthcare workers. Now, with the convenient emergence of the Omicron variant, calls are being made to have Western countries make a major push to vaccinate the vaccine-hesitant African continent. Joining me today to discuss these complex issues and more is Jeremy Lofredo. Jeremy is a journalist and researcher based in Washington, D.C. He is currently a reporter for Children's Health Defense and contributes to both Unlimited Hangout and The Gray Zone. Last year, Jeremy and I co-wrote a series about the COVID-19 vaccination campaign and race politics with a focus on the U.S., and more recently, he has covered, alongside Max Blumenthal, the digital identity agenda behind the vaccine passport rollout. Great to have you on the podcast, Jeremy. Finally, it's been a long time coming. How's it going?
Thank you, Whitney. I'm doing very well.
All right, wonderful. So, as I sort of mentioned in this intro, just in the past week, some mainstream media outlets have been publishing reports about how vaccine hesitancy, as opposed to vaccine equity, is to blame for the lower vaccination rates observed in Africa, which they often refer to as the least vaccinated continent. So, one example of that comes from CBC News, which I believe is the state-funded, official outlet of Canada, from earlier this week saying vaccine inequity only partially to blame for Africa's low vaccination rates, experts say. Quoting various people, including one of the main members of the COVID-19 task team in South Africa, saying that part of it is that the main issues are not really so much vaccine inequity, but health system capacity and vaccine hesitancy. The article goes on to note, for example, that 40% of vaccines that have arrived on the continent have not been used, and that's according to the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. And in addition to that, there's a quote in here from the president of Namibia saying that the government there had to destroy 150,000 expired doses because those who are eligible are, quote, refusing to be vaccinated. And this has also been reported on by the Washington Post, some other outlets as well, and that it goes on to reference, in addition to that, that there's a lot of hesitancy from healthcare workers, with only 1 in 4 of healthcare workers in the entire continent being vaccinated or fully vaccinated, and that these healthcare workers in Africa have declined to do so due to concerns over vaccine safety and adverse side effects, and that's coming directly from the World Health Organization. And of course, this isn't exclusive to Canada's CBC News. This is also a story that was reported at the end of November in the Associated Press, republished by ABC News and a lot of other mainstream outlets. So now that vaccine hesitancy on the African continent seems to be
an issue of increasing, I guess, focus from the mainstream media in the West. I know that you've done a lot of extensive research on vaccine hesitancy in the African continent in general. So what are some past events that could have led to this situation we're now seeing on the African continent?
Sure. So yeah, hesitancy with vaccines is not a new issue in Africa. And, you know, this is quote unquote hesitancy. This is not a word that I would use. It's just, you know, this is blatant resistance. They aren't hesitant. They don't want it. And there's several vaccines that have been administered on the continent of Africa that have had devastating effects that are not given to any other continent. And I'm assuming that the African people understand this. And when they're told that there's a brand new vaccine, they're very skeptical. One of these vaccines is the DTP vaccine, the diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccine. It's a bundle of three immunization shots given to virtually every child on the African continent. But it's not currently administered in the U.S. Or most other developed nations. And, you know, for a long time, as far back as 1977, The Lancet established that the risks of the whole cell pertussis jab, which is the P in the DTP vaccine, are greater than the risks associated with contracting wild pertussis. So after mounting evidence linking the drug to brain damage, seizures, and even death, the U.S. Phased it out in the 1990s and replaced it with a safer version called DTAP, DTAP, that did not contain the whole pertussis cell. But today, African nations are still being financially incentivized to continue using the out-of-date, deeply dangerous DTP vaccine with Gavi, Gates's Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, making DTP a priority for African children. A 2017 study funded by the Danish government actually concluded that there were more African children dying at the hands of the DTP vaccine than by the disease it's supposed to prevent. The researchers found that boys were dying at almost quadruple the rate of those who had not received the shot, while girls suffered almost 10 times the death rate. So, of course, parents and children are seeing their friends, you know, getting these vaccines sent in by the West, and the ones who get the vaccine are way less healthy than the ones not receiving the vaccine. And this is, you know, something that you notice pretty quickly if it's happening all around you. And another vaccine is the malaria vaccine, which it was just recommended by the WHO that it be given to the entire African continent. But from 2009 to 2011, its phase three clinical trials, funded by the Gates Foundation and manufactured by GlaxoSmithKline, took place in Ghana, Kenya, Malawi, Mozambique, Burkina Faso, Gabon, and Tanzania. And in 2011, their own data showed that female children were dying from any cause at more than twice the rate of those in the control group. And children who received the vaccine also had a risk of meningitis that was 10 times higher than those who did not receive the vaccine. And despite this, the WHO was still coordinating the administration of the vaccine to 700,000 children in these countries as part of, it called it a pilot implementation. And even the BMJ said that this pilot implementation process, it implies consent. So it means that this is a direct quote, recipients of the malaria vaccine are not being informed that they are in a study. So now this vaccine is being recommended by the WHO. Gates is WHO. He's the, you know, number two or three funder to every child in Africa. So, you know, these are just two examples, and the examples go on and on. So when these people hear that there's a brand new vaccine from the West that, you know, skipped most of the safety processes, they're rightly skeptical, you know?
Right. So I think there's actually a couple other vaccines sort of in the same model, what you described with the DTP vaccine, in the sense that vaccines that are determined to be unsafe or unsuitable for public use in the West are more often than not basically, you know, sent to the developing world where their use is incentivized by groups like Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, which, as you mentioned, has a lot of ties to the Gates Foundation, and a lot of people frame them as a, you know, a philanthropic nonprofit. But if you look at their website, they make it very clear that their mission is not to necessarily protect public health. It's about the health of vaccine markets. They're specifically concerned about vaccine markets and creating healthy conditions for vaccine markets. And this is the type of language they use on their own website. And this is something that is not exclusive just to Africa. It also happens in Latin America as well. One example that you're probably familiar with, Jeremy, is the polio vaccine, whereas in the polio vaccines available in the West use inactivated viruses. But those used in Africa and where I live in Chile, for example, are live viruses. But even the WHO has called this out for being an unsafe vaccine in the sense that it's causing polio outbreaks, and it was determined not to be suitable for use in the West, but is being widely used and has its use incentivized in these other countries, despite the risks. And obviously people aren't being informed of the risks. They're just added to like the childhood immunization schedules. At least that's how it is here in Chile. And they don't exactly tell people that, you know, this is the polio vaccine for the developing world, and that the developed world has a different, safer version of this, you know, that sort of gets left out of the conversation. And, you know, a lot of the groups, including Gavi, that are incentivizing this use, you know, as I mentioned earlier, they're focused on finding markets for these newly homeless vaccines that were previously used in the West, right? So what's interesting, though, is, you know, in that context, Chile, for example, is definitely not vaccine hesitant when it comes to specifically the COVID-19 vaccine, but other vaccines as well. You know, despite this, but I would argue that has to do with a very big difference in terms of public trust in healthcare institutions and the media and the government in general. And I think that's why, you know, in the case of Chile, they're the world leader in booster doses right now in terms of a percent of the population, whereas Africa, you know, is the most under-vaccinated continent in the world to date. I think, you know, in the case of Africa as well, in contrast to a country like Chile, you also have a lot of history with some of the big names involved with the COVID-19 vaccination campaign as well, like Pfizer having a pretty notorious track record in Africa. I think in Nigeria specifically, where they had that particular trial that resulted in them being found guilty of a lot of malfeasance and having to pay out a pretty hefty sum to a lot of families that were lied to, and whose botched trial there, I believe in the 1990s, led to a lot of dead kids.
Yeah, of course. And during that same, you know, legal back and forth that was happening with Pfizer and Nigeria actually, it came out that they hired a private security firm to dig up blackmail on the Attorney General of Nigeria to try to then get him to drop the case.
Holy shit.
So of course, you know, those are not the people who are going to, you know, just come on in, Pfizer. It's just not going to happen. They've been crossed too many times.
Yeah, it also makes you wonder too, because well, you're talking about, you know, efforts of a corporation to sort of interfere through blackmail, you know, with the functioning of a government in Africa. And there has been a lot of strange stuff, strange for lack of a better word, that's gone in Africa geopolitically ever since March 2020, when the whole COVID-19 crisis started. And I think that might also be a factor potentially in some of this quote unquote vaccine hesitancy being observed in Africa, because you have the case of, I don't know, for example, John Magufuli, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, in Tanzania. You and I co-authored a piece about him, but pretty early on, you know, he sort of did an expose, I guess you could say, of the PCR test, and that, you know, a papaya and a goat and samples taken from things that weren't people were found to be positive cases, and called it out for fear-mongering, and some other things, and various countries declined not to go into lockdown. But there were also a lot of very suspicious deaths, not just Magufuli's, of course, but, you know, I think a total of like 6 African leaders died sudden deaths in a very short period of time once the COVID-19 crisis began. And obviously, when you have that type of high death rate for politicians, considering the relatively low COVID death rate for the African politician as a whole, I think that could possibly lead to people being a little more skeptical of what is going on, because they're not just seeing, you know, this talk of pandemic and vaccines and all of that. There's also major geopolitical shifts happening.
Definitely. Yeah, I became aware, I feel like, of the resistance to the COVID vaccine in the Global South while we were working on our investigative piece on the late John Magufuli of Tanzania. You know, he was framed as this crazy anti-vaxxer who didn't care about COVID, this and that. He declined lockdowns. He declined mass testing. He declined to order any COVID vaccines from COVAX. And during that time, as we noted in our piece, even the hawkish Council on Foreign Relations, who was calling for regime change in Tanzania at the time, admitted in their article titled Tanzania's COVID Denialism Harms Its Economic Future. They admit that, quote, Tanzanians agree with the government's light touch COVID approach. So I read that and I thought to myself, wow, that's so wild. Here in the West, we're being told, you know, he's dangerous, he's anti-vaxxer, he's this and that. But it's actually, he's just, you know, exercising the democratic will of the Tanzanian people, who seem to not really buy the whole COVID narrative. They don't want the vaccine. So to see the Council on Foreign Relations admit, even during a push for regime change in Tanzania, that most of Tanzanians agreed with him, that was that sort of made me realize how Africans were, or Tanzanians specifically, looked at the situation. And it opened the door for me to look further into how other African countries and what's happening there with the COVID vaccines.
Well, from outlets like the CFR and groups like that, when they call for regime change in a country, you know, and they even, you know, they'll make similar arguments to that, right? And people normally at like progressive media or anti-imperialist media, however, they tend to define themselves these days, I guess, usually catch on to that kind of stuff. Like, oh, he's doing what the people want. Isn't it weird that the CFR is calling for regime change, but instead we've had a lot of voices that would normally be skeptical of these calls for regime change. Of course, this is before Magufuli died under very odd circumstances. But they're sort of, you know, backing this whole narrative in the case of him, you know, that he was, you know, a bad leader and was hurting his population. But he's actually, you know, had the support of his domestic population. And even the new president, who was his vice president, who's taken over since, I don't think she has really even gone that far in terms of implementing strict COVID policies, COVID related policies, either, because it's not supported by the population there, right? Which I think is pretty significant. But turning back to the vaccine and equity discussion, you know, if the issue, as is being admitted now, is really more about vaccine hesitancy than vaccine inequity, it's kind of odd that there's this push coming mainly from the progressive side to basically flood Africa with vaccines that is now being admitted they don't want. It's almost sort of like, well, we know what's best for you is almost sort of implicit in that. And it's kind of an odd stance to take, because in other circumstances, these same outlets would not make that argument. Or even a couple years ago, in a different context, wouldn't it be making that argument? It would be deemed, I would think, right, sort of colonialist, imperialist, to say, I know what's best for this country in Africa, even though I'm a person living in New York City or something like that, right?
Of course. And it's not even, I know what's best for this African country or that African country. It's, I know what's best for this African country. And what's best is Pfizer, you know, a multinational corporate conglomerate with, you know, billions and billions of dollars of, you know, criminal settlements. So it's not even that they're saying, I know what's best. You know, I know they need, you know, clean water there. It's no, I know they need, you know, this product that is super profitable. So that is very ironic to see that type of dialogue happening on what we would normally consider the anti-imperialist left.
Well, it's even more ironic in the context of booster doses. You know, you recently had Jacinda Ardern of New Zealand basically say this is a vaccine campaign that's never going to end. You know, we're in various countries having the rollout of the booster dose, and countries far advanced with the booster dose, like Chile and Israel, plans are already being made for a fourth dose. Various places have essentially admitted that this is going to be a several times a year, potentially every 3 months, right? So once you get a country, you know, heavily vaccinated, I guess you could say, and you introduce these vaccine mandates or these vaccine passports in order to maintain those privileges, you have to have constant booster doses. I mean, there's an obvious profit motive there for Pfizer, Moderna, and a lot of these other companies, because it's, you know, the billions in profits they've seen over the past year is something that they can count on for decades, potentially forever, as opposed to just having it be a 1 year boost to their stock price and profits. I mean, obviously it's in their interest to advance that. And it's weird that it's been essentially ignored. The great controversy within both the FDA and the CDC about the need for booster doses in the US, which, you know, you would assume would point to this being not so much about science and being significantly influenced by this profit motive. You know, if you're looking at it in that context, it definitely is weird to want to sort of rope in Africa, I guess you could say, which is under vaccinated, because essentially, you know, it was even admitted by the Associated Press not that long ago, right? I think a couple weeks before the emergence of the Omicron variant, that academics and scientists were baffled at how COVID isn't really a problem in Africa, essentially saying that, you know, there's low cases, there's not a lot of disruption to daily life, and there's a, you know, it's the least vaccinated continent in the world. You know, what's going on here? So, you know, these continued pushes to sort of flood the continent with vaccines when COVID's not really a problem there. I mean, it just, there's some things that should be, you know, bringing up some questions for some of these people, and it's increasingly not. And I find that personally a bit alarming.
Yeah, of course. And they even in that same AP article, I believe they mentioned that, you know, it's the most under-vaccinated continent in the world. But at the same time, it appears on the WHO's least affected list by the pandemic. Week after week after week, it's on this list that names the places that are least affected by the pandemic. And here, right at the top of the list, you have the place with the least vaccines. So, you know, you'd hope that that raises, you know, some questions, because it definitely did for me. And, you know, these same progressives who are going to get their booster and talking about, you know, vaccine inequity, why are you getting more vaccines? You know, these people are so unbelievably frightened of the COVID from all of the propaganda that they haven't been able to think very clearly, I think.
Yeah, well, I'm going to hope that's the case as to why these, you know, pushes are being made from that specific side, I guess you could say, of the political spectrum within independent media. I really hope it has to that's why, and not something potentially more nefarious. I mean, maybe it is from, you know, some of the bigger names pushing this, perhaps. But yeah, I think the impact of the fear. I mean, obviously, you're not going to be thinking as rationally about, you know, the long term consequences of this and the all the different aspects of this sort of thing if you're afraid. Right. Because obviously that reduces the amount of time you spend thinking about the ins and outs of something. If you're afraid, you tend to be more impulsive and also more receptive to, you know, we have to do something and this is the solution. But if you look at a lot of, you know, the outlets or at least the origin sources of a lot of these vaccine inequity claims originally, you know, again, we see the head of Gavi being one of the main voices quoted in articles, and that going back since the vaccine rollout for COVID-19 really began. And again, this is someone who's tasked with protecting the health of vaccine markets. So obviously, you know, they want a market for COVID-19 vaccines in Africa, in despite of the fact of what the population has actually been willing to voluntarily do. And that's why this emergence of the Omicron variant I find very interesting. So this was actually, I believe, admitted first in a New York Times article. There might have been someone in independent media that saw it sooner, but I saw it first in the New York Times in an article published on December 1st. It opened the article, which says Africa, comma, far behind on vaccines. Every other continent is ahead. Starts with the first sentence. It says, last week, just days before scientists discovered the Omicron variant, South Africa's government asked Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer not to make some planned deliveries for COVID-19 vaccines. And this had to do with, as they say below, it was because of vaccine skepticism. Yeah. And then the Omicron variant is announced. There's lots of fear mongering around it, even though officially, the astounding thing is that officially it's been attributed to zero deaths. I don't know about how many hospitalizations, but it's been being widely described, including by the people in South Africa who first identified it, as being extremely mild. A lot of the cases that have been reported on or discovered of the Omicron variant are taking place not just in double vaccinated people, but people also with the booster dose. So I think that's worth noting. But as soon as the Omicron variant was reported on, there were a lot of changes. So first of all, in South Africa, South Africa's government, which had previously rejected vaccine mandates, began considering them because of Omicron, the Omicron variant specifically, with that being reported on by CNBC by December 2nd. But then subsequently, pieces in Politico said, Omicron raises concerns about global vaccine equity and hesitancy, and basically saying that the Omicron variant's emergence is because the African continent is not sufficiently vaccinated. And it has a quote from near the beginning from the CEO of Gavi, Seth Berkley, saying, we will only prevent variants from emerging if we are able to protect all of the world's population, not just the wealthy parts. And this was also, this argument was also seen in ABC News, which said, I guess it's an Associated Press piece republished by them. The headline is Omicron brings COVID-19 vaccine inequity home to roost, that essentially the lack of vaccination on the African continent, which is now being admitted to be largely due to vaccine hesitancy and not so much vaccine inequity, is a global threat. This is quite a significant shift, but it seems to be focused around wanting to provoke political changes in Africa as it relates to things like vaccine mandates. And some of these articles I just mentioned that specifically, but there also seems to be sort of this suggestion that the vaccine hesitancy observed within Africa is now a threat to the entire world. And this is all being based off of, you know, the Omicron variant, which, as I mentioned earlier, has officially killed no one. Your thoughts?
Yeah. So to people who were following, you know, what was going on in Africa in terms of the COVID-19 push, COVID-19 vaccine push, many countries were not taking it and did not want it. And so I'm sure that they saw this early on and they, you know, decided to kind of pivot from a, we need to send them vaccines, to it's a national security issue if they don't take the vaccines. You know, so just, this is Reuters from a few months ago. This is a quote from Reuters. It says, there are fears in the Ivory Coast that vaccine doses will go unused. Reuters observed vaccine centers, quote, in densely populated areas with health workers sitting idle with no patients. And this is an entire Reuters article about how nobody wants the vaccine. So it was there's a lot of great info. And it says in the Congo, 10 days into their vaccine program, only 1,300 Congolese people out of 85 million went out to receive their COVID vaccine. And the government went on to return 1.3 million doses to COVAX. So that's from a Reuters article right there, like several months ago, saying that people in all of these countries don't want the vaccine. Meanwhile, here you had, you know, lines down the block to get the vaccine. And those same people were saying, we need to send them to Africa. And then you have Bloomberg reported over the summer that Burundi's democratically elected government, and I think they had a interesting
suspicious death
change of government in the middle of COVID. Yeah, Burundi's democratically elected government. They said that the vaccines, quote, aren't fully effective and long-term side effects are not understood, and that we don't want vaccines which are still, quote, at the experimental stage. And then they were offered an IMF aid package, $100 million or something like that. But it must have stipulated that they will take vaccines. So they took the IMF package, and the day after, they agreed to allow COVAX vaccines into the country, Gates's COVAX into the country. But it would seem that they accepted the vaccines for the aid money and only that, because 3,000 doses have been given in Burundi, but they've received 500,000 doses of China's Sinopharm vaccine and 2.4 million doses of the J&J vaccine. So that's over 3 million doses of vaccine that they have, and only 3,000 doses have been given. So we can assume very high, quote unquote, hesitancy in Burundi.
Well, that's if I can just interrupt you for a second, it's interesting you bring up the IMF, because there was a claim, I think, from the leader of Belarus that he was offered an aid package by the, I believe it was the IMF, it might have been the World Bank, but, you know, they're similar institutions at the end of the day, to basically implement lockdowns and other COVID-19 related policies in exchange for aid money. There was claims also that a shift in COVID-19 policy from Russia was connected to an IMF aid package that was negotiated just days before that move was announced. And if I'm not mistaken, her name is Kristina Georgieva, the head of the IMF right now, who's also on the board of trustees of the World Economic Forum. She's made several speeches over the past several months, essentially saying that the vaccine program is directly related to prospects for economic recovery, and that there won't really be an economic recovery from COVID-19 until the world is fully vaccinated. And that's sort of in some way similar to this argument that the world won't be safe from variants until everyone is fully vaccinated either.
Yeah, from the head of the IMF during a speech, she said vaccine policy is economic policy.
That's the quote. Yeah.
And it was, you know, it kind of sounds like a threat when you're the IMF and you have so much control over the economies of these poor countries. So, you know, that's very interesting. And you also have Haiti. You know, which is a country that has been treated horribly by the U.S. and related health and medical NGOs. They sent back their Moderna vaccines a couple months ago because they weren't being used, because there was low demand. So these countries that historically have been, you know, colonized feel, you know, they feel that the COVID vaccines are just an extension of, you know, U.S. imperialism. And, you know, they might have a point. USAID has made, you know, vaccine uptake, you know, a giant priority. And then you have this survey, which I saw recently from Afrobarometer from over the summer. I just saw it, though, and it looked at the opinions of the pandemic and, you know, quote unquote, hesitancy in Africa. And the findings were, you know, very interesting, especially considering this whole vaccine apartheid narrative that we're talking about. It surveyed Benin, Liberia, Niger, Senegal, and Togo. And only 9%, so that's less than 1 out of 10 people of Senegal sees themselves, quote, very likely to try and get vaccinated for COVID-19. 86% of Niger believes COVID will not be a serious problem or not be a problem at all over the next 6 months. And 77% of respondents in the 5 African countries surveyed believed the exact same. And it also found that 79% of Senegalese people and 66% of Liberians consider it, quote, highly unlikely that they will try to get back. And one last thing from this survey was 83% of Senegal, 78% of Liberia, and 62% of Togo, quote, did not trust at all or trust only a little the safety of the COVID vaccine. So, you know, while we have people in Brooklyn, you know, taking Ubers to the Pfizer headquarters to organize the, you know, these die-ins where they lay dead on the ground, which is supposed to, you know, it's almost a form of blackface. You're acting like a dead African, saying, you know, this is what's happening in Africa if you don't send over more vaccines. When actual Africans are, you know, rejecting the COVID vaccine in mass. You know, these numbers are stunning. The hesitancy in these countries is way, way higher than the hesitancy that we see in the West. So a pretty prominent anti-imperialist journalist, like in the alt media a couple months ago, she had a tweet that she sent that went pretty viral, and it sort of encapsulated the mainstream narrative, where she claimed that vaccine hesitancy is a privilege of the global North. And everyone was like, oh, that's so true. So true. You know, people in the US who won't take the vaccine are selfish. There's people in Africa who can't even get a vaccine, which isn't true. But it's, you're seeing more and more that this hesitancy, which is apparently a privilege in the global North, is actually much more, prevalent in the global South, and uptake is much higher here, especially where I am, at least in the United States.
Well, I think there was also before this relatively recent shift admitting the extent of quote unquote vaccine hesitancy in Africa, there were some efforts to claim or to create the perception in the West that there was actually a high demand for the COVID-19 vaccine in Africa. I think I originally saw this because it was put out by, I think, on Aaron Matei's Twitter. I could be wrong on that. But it was essentially saying, making that claim. And if I'm not mistaken, you responded and noted that that particular study was financed by, I believe, Bill Gates affiliated entities.
Yeah, so it was this study that I peered. I could be wrong. I believe it's The Lancet. And it was widely, widely shared as, you know, scientific proof that, you know, Africa is highly willing to, you know, take these vaccines. And you know, it was shared by all of these public health professors and, you know, all these influencers, and also Aaron Matei. And you look at the study, and it wasn't only, you know, funded by Bill Gates, but the study itself was funded by Bill Gates, but where they got their numbers from were from organizations, three different organizations that were all funded by Bill Gates. So it was funded by Bill Gates in like four different ways. And it was being shared by these anti-imperialists and leftists as, you know, scientific proof of something. And, you know, of course, we all know that Bill Gates is no, you know, medical professional or scientist or researcher or any of those things. And he funds things, you know, to get his point across.
Yeah, well, I mean, before he was a quote unquote philanthropist with the launch of his foundation in, I guess it was 2002 or 2001. He was palling around with, you know, this one lady that's currently on trial, Ghislaine Maxwell, Jeffrey Epstein, a fun crowd, you know, and was also under investigation by the U.S. federal government for violating antitrust laws. You know, he didn't exactly have the PR appeal that his quote unquote philanthropy has afforded him today, but it's worth noting, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, Jeremy, because I know you've done some pretty extensive reporting on Bill Gates, is that he frames, or has in the past, framed his quote-unquote philanthropy around, you know, returns on investments, and he's pretty explicit about sort of identifying his philanthropy as related to investments and in return on investment specifically, and has said in the past that vaccines is one of the best ways to maximize your philanthropic return on investments. And I will just make a quick note that particular line of philanthropy, Jeffrey Epstein was very central in the development of that, both through his involvement with the Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation, but also some sort of tangentially linked figures and their philanthropic shifts during that same period, 2000-2001, when those previous foundations were launched, like the Milken Institute, you know, also sort of take that approach to philanthropy as well. And it was deemed philanthropy 2.0 by the media at the time. But they, you know, it was also noted that it's not really philanthropy. It's a way of essentially doing business as usual, but framing it as philanthropy, so you get a PR boost by essentially engaging in the same sort of predatory corporate behavior, in the case of Michael Milken, corporate raider behavior that these people have, been doing for a long time. And it's worth noting also that Epstein's own foundations were launched in that same time period as well.
Yeah, so I believe it was a CBS interview where he said outright, like you said, that his return on investment with vaccines is unlike anything else that he invests in. It's 20-1 ROI. So that's wild. And kind of lets you know where his priorities are. It's not how many lives he's saving, this or that. It's just a good investment. And the reason that it's so ironic that you have the anti-imperialist left and the left asking for more vaccines to be sent to these places is because, you know, it's Bill Gates's COVAX that facilitates that. And it was originally set up by Gates in the beginning of COVID, and it's, quote, a worldwide initiative aimed at equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines. It sounds awesome. So how it works is rich countries listen to the calls of, you know, the progressive left and to end the vaccine apartheid. And that essentially manufactures consent for them to take billions in public funds and tax money and hand it over to Gates's COVAX, who in turn hands it over to Pfizer, who then gives COVAX vaccines for our tax money. And then they bring them to poor countries. So Pfizer makes a lot of money from this Gates scheme to bring vaccines to the global south. And it's only really allowed through, it gets public support through these calls by the so-called anti-imperialist left or the, you know, leftists to fix this vaccine inequity problem. And it just sends public funds into Pfizer's pockets. So ending vaccine apartheid is actually, you know, it's just business as usual. It's just taking public funds and giving it over to the pharmaceutical industry, which is, that's not progressive.
I just find it an interesting interesting that they refer to the alleged vaccine inequity issue as vaccine apartheid. But, you know, it's a much larger part of the equation than previously acknowledged. Now that's being openly acknowledged by mainstream media. So how can you continue to go on claiming it's apartheid if it's you're depriving people of something they don't want? It's just kind of I don't know, it seems almost like a marketing a ploy in a sense. It's very disappointing to see, especially in the context of things like I don't know, vaccine passports that definitely have much more similarities to an apartheid style system. Not necessarily in terms of, you know, between the global south and the global north, right? But within societies, these same people saying vaccine inequity is vaccine apartheid don't really see the issues inherent within a vaccine passport system. And there have been claims from, I think it's the state of Edo, in Nigeria, that said they've had different leaders there say, or attempt to increase vaccination rates by claiming you won't be able to access banking services. You won't be able to attend church and other things without the COVID-19 vaccine. And people there continue to resist, essentially. But it's, why wouldn't they call out that particular, I don't know. I just think the terminology that they're trying to use it for is sort of misplaced, especially in the context of what's now being openly admitted here. But before we get more, because I know there's a lot, of course, that we could say and should say about the vaccine passport angle to all of this, because I think it is, it definitely does sort of answer the reason as to why the focus is so explicitly on vaccinating the whole world, you know, ID 2020, digital ID and all of that we can get into later, which, you know, obviously has a lot of connections to Gavi as well. But before we get there, sort of what I was mentioning earlier in these recent articles from Politico and ABC News and the Associated Press about Omicron raising concerns about Africa's vaccine equity and hesitancy problems. There's sort of this, implication in these articles that the fact that Africa isn't has low vaccine uptake, that it's voluntary, under voluntary conditions when it comes to taking the vaccine, there's low vaccine uptake, that this is essentially a threat from the from Africa to the rest of the world. I find that a little bit alarming, because some of the people that have been really big in promoting the vaccine inequity narrative, like Democracy Now, for example, on December 7th, they featured a woman who wrote an article in Vanity Fair called Catherine Aben, I believe is her name. And she was essentially saying the problem is shifting from not enough doses, i.e. vaccine inequity. Vaccine inequity isn't the problem anymore. She's saying now it's not enough support on the ground to administer doses. Talking about this plan from the Biden administration to increase global vaccinations that's apparently stalled. So this is apparently one of the focal points of this Biden plan, is to get more support on the ground to administer vaccine doses in Africa. This really concerns me, because who does Biden want to send to Africa to administer doses to a vaccine hesitant population? Any ideas? I don't want to get carried away there, but it definitely seems sort of like a way for Biden to push through longstanding efforts from the U.S. national security state related to AFRICOM, U.S. military presence in Africa, which has really been exploding over the past several years. And given the heavy involvement, for example, of the U.S. military in the U.S. domestic COVID-19 vaccination campaign, it definitely wouldn't be that weird. And my question is, what outlets like Democracy Now, if that was actually proposed, I mean, are we at a point where they would be essentially cheering that on? I mean, seems pretty wild to me, but really not that far-fetched anymore.
It definitely seems wild, but Democracy Now has, you know, if it's under the guise of public health or humanitarian aid, and they push that hard enough, I don't think Democracy Now would have a problem supporting it. And there's a researcher, Jake Levitch. He wrote about how the Ebola crisis was used by the U.S. military, and it goes along exactly with what you just said. He said the Ebola crisis offered useful cover for a substantial escalation in U.S. military presence. Calling Ebola a, quote, top national security priority for the United States in September 2014, the White House authorized the deployment of 3,000 troops to Liberia, Sierra Leone, Nigeria, and Senegal under AFRICOM command, more than doubling U.S. military presence in Africa and simultaneously establishing a new military base in Monrovia. So it wouldn't be the first time that we sent, you know, AFRICOM troops into these countries, you know, boosting our military presence in Africa under the guise of not only public health, but pandemic. You know, this happened just with Ebola. And I'm sure they have not forgotten that they've already used this before. And it worked. They doubled U.S. military presence in Africa under the guise of Ebola. And Tony Blair just wrote a piece, actually, in The Telegraph this week, where he explained that Africa does in fact have enough doses. He explains that it's not lack of vaccines, but the problem that is a national security or health risk is the fact that they aren't taking them. You know, the idea that they're not taking them.
All right, Tony Blair says free Africans' free will is a threat to national security. And essentially, that's promising. Yeah. Jesus. Okay.
And then you also have the former Biden administration senior COVID advisor Andy Slavitt, who has like a vaccine in his Twitter name. He's become like a kind of a COVID influencer on the internet. He said he does these crazy long COVID threads that get tons and tons of engagement. And he said, I guess it was last month, He called for a troop invasion, essentially, of Haiti and Africa under the guise of public health humanitarian aid, to like vaccinate people. He said that we've thankfully pulled our troops out of Afghanistan. It may be time to send them to Africa and Haiti to assist with vaccination efforts and saving lives. That's someone who literally came from the White House is speaking like this. And I can't, it's very rarely that troops are going anywhere to save lives, especially Africa and Haiti.
Yeah, well, if the issue was vaccine hesitancy, right?
Yes.
And as you mentioned earlier, several of these countries see this as an extension of Western imperialism, and that is potentially likely a factor for the vaccine hesitancy. How the heck is sending US troops or foreign troops into those countries going to reduce vaccine hesitancy?
Yes, it's. I mean, it's something that they've made clear they don't want the vaccine. So if we're sending troops there, to are we forcing it into their arms with U.S. soldiers? Like, what are the troops doing? We've already made clear in the Reuters piece that in the Ivory Coast, obviously this is just one of many countries, but it's a good example that the vaccine centers in densely populated areas, health workers are sitting idle with no patients. So what do they need US troops for? They're already sitting idle with no patients. So I don't know what the US.
Yeah, it's either cover for other operations unrelated to COVID-19, or it's something pretty freaking nefarious. Though, the first case is actually probably pretty likely. As we wrote about in our article about John Magufuli of Tanzania, there's a lot of interest specifically about these minerals for the green. Well, Green Revolution was the Gates-funded Monsanto imperialism in India and stuff, but I guess the green energy revolution with like lithium-ion batteries and electric vehicles, which are predominantly going to be used in the West, but the minerals are coming from South America and from Africa. And there's a limited supply of those, and you have cobalt metals, for example, which is not just Bill Gates, it's Jeff Bezos, Marc Benioff, Mark Zuckerberg, Reid Hoffman, the big, Silicon Valley billionaires essentially saying we need all of the world's cobalt, all of the world's nickel, all of the world's lithium in order to do this. And that specific company plans to tap into as many of those reserves as possible. And Africa is huge for mining, as of course are the Andes in South America, where a lot of the lithium and copper is, but a lot of the world's cobalt and nickel is in Africa. Whether I think Congo is one of the main countries involved with a lot of the world's nickel mines. Tanzania, Magufuli got in trouble right before his disappearance, actually. Because he had nationalized the largest nickel ready to mine nickel deposit and taken it away from Glencore and Barrick Gold, and instead gone into a joint venture with a separate company where the Tanzanian government was actually going to make some profit off of it instead of having all of the profits go to foreigners and the Tanzanian people be left with nothing, which is the historic model for the mining industry in these places. The profits don't really stay in the country and they don't benefit the local population. So if this happens, it could be one of the driving factors is to sort of maintain control of these mining deposits that are deemed essential, because a lot of this has to do with this artificial intelligence and fourth industrial revolution arms race between the US and China, with China having a lot of advantages economically in terms of its relationship with governments in Africa and also South America as it relates to mining, and China itself having a huge advantage over access to rare earth minerals relative to the United States. And the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence, which is headed by a Silicon Valley billionaire, Eric Schmidt, made some of this stuff pretty explicit in their report pretty recently about this being you know, getting control of these minerals and also winning the AI arms race against China was essential to the U.S. maintaining its military and economic hegemony, which, of course, if you're familiar with U.S. empire, is really the driving motive behind most U.S. Government policy.
Yeah, but I'm sure that they will send troops into Africa, you know, to advance public health.
Yeah, well, I mean, I definitely think that's a possibility, but I think also, you know, some of the stuff that's underlying a lot of what we see as COVID-19 policy, including things like vaccine passports, there's sort of this underlying motive that's obviously there related to, you know, this whole fourth industrial revolution push that we're seeing going on sort of simultaneously with the COVID-19 crisis. And this is actually something that, of course, I have covered pretty extensively, but you've covered to a great extent as well, most recently with Max Blumenthal at the Gray Zone, about the link between vaccine passports and digital ID. And of course, digital ID, even before COVID-19, was mentioned and flagged really as the cornerstone to being able to bring into effect the fourth industrial revolution, which is essentially a digitalization of the entire global economy. But per its, you know, proponents and the people that invented the term, it's more than that. You know, they describe it as a merging of the physical, digital and virtual worlds and all of this stuff. But essentially, it's this digital ID push that's really foundational for that. And in order for this to really happen for the people that stand to benefit from that huge shift, this industrial revolution, as it's being called, the vast majority of the world needs to be involved in these digital ID systems. And some of these have been tested out in Africa well before COVID-19. There's the Gavi Wellness Pass, which is a team up between the Gavi Vaccine Alliance, one of the founding members of ID 2020, with MasterCard, which is now an ID 2020 member as well. I forget exactly which part of Africa, but it was to link vaccine credentials and health records with cashless payment systems. And this is this pilot program, which was launched before COVID-19, had COVID-19 vaccine passports rolled into it as it was being piloted. So since you've written extensively on this topic, how do you see the link between digital ID and vaccine passports and how this push to, for, you know, that we've been talking about, this push to vaccinate the African continent, presumably against their will because of the quote unquote vaccine hesitancy issue? You know, how does this all connect?
The military surveillance firm and NATO contractor Thales, I'm not sure exactly how you pronounce it, they say outright on their website that vaccine passports are a precursor to digital ID. So that kind of, you know, sets the tone of why the military industrial complex and, you know, Western governments and multinational corporations, where their heads are at. They're not saying that it's a precursor to great health. No, it's a precursor to a digital ID, a vaccine passport. You know, the CEO of iProof, which is a biometric digital ID company, they told Forbes that the evolution of vaccine certificates will actually drive the whole field of digital ID in the future. So therefore, it's not just about COVID. This is about something even bigger. Even Anne Kavoukian, who is the Foreign Privacy Commissioner of Ontario, Canada, she described the vaccine passport system that is already active in her province as, quote, a new inescapable web of surveillance with geolocation data being tracked everywhere. So what we did in our piece is we looked at, you know, digital ID systems that are currently in the works around the world. And some of them have been in the works, actually, for a good amount of time, including India's Aadhaar system, which is, you know, the biggest biometric ID system in the world. It has over 1 billion people enrolled, and the problems with the system have been widely reported on in, you know, only Indian media, but Indian media has reported on how this system is responsible for, you know, starvation after starvation after starvation, because people, poor people, have to get their government services through there. So they get their unemployment, they get their food rations through this Aadhaar system. And the biometric technology that they use apparently is not as good as it should be, because people's rations are being sent to other people. People's fingerprints aren't working. Their irises aren't scanning correctly, and they're being cut off from their rations. They're being, their government services are being ended, and people are starving to death. And this has been reported on, you know, time and time again in India's poorer communities. And what we did was we looked at how the man responsible for the Aadhaar system, Nidhar Kalani, I don't know how you pronounce his name, is a big hero, quote unquote. Like, this is a direct quote. Bill Gates has called him a hero. And you have Kalani also on the board of ID4D, which is a World Bank initiative to bring digital ID to, you know, developing countries. And, you know, we talked about, you know, ID 2020 as well, which I know you've done reporting on. And, you know, you have Seth Berkley saying that, you know, 89% of the children and adolescents without identification live in countries supported by Gavi, meaning countries that Gavi gives vaccines to. We are enthusiastic about the potential impact of this program, not just in Bangladesh, but as something we can replicate across Gavi eligible countries. And this is him talking about a digital ID program. He wants to bring it to every country that they bring vaccines to. And this is also highlighted in a paper written by the Gates Foundation and ID 2020 and USAID partnered biometric ID firm Simprints, a biometric technology firm. They wrote a paper called COVID-19 Vaccine Delivery, an Opportunity to Set Up Systems for the Future. And what they argue is that COVID-19 vaccines in the global south could be used as a, quote, potential lever to deliver digital biometric IDs. So when you see this crazy vaccine push to get people vaccinated, it's really, it's less about, in my opinion, to get people vaccinated, but more about just finding these people and issuing them IDs and ways to track, you know, officially how, if they've been vaccinated, but unofficially just, you know, plain track, and give them also attached to the digital IDs, as you've reported for ID 2020 will be, you know, digital payment cards. So now you're tracking not only their health status, but their payments and how they spend their money and what they spend their money on. And this has been, you know, happening in the global south for some time, the digital IDs. And now it's finally, you see it coming to the global north, with vaccine passports happening everywhere. And it's just another form of, you know, surveillance. And you have, we talked about the M-Pesa, which you might have heard of. And it was, you know, trialed in Africa. And it allowed users to digitally deposit, withdraw, transfer, and pay with digital money. And the project was, quote, able to make credit and growth capital available to millions of people who have never had access to credit before. And, you know, this is a big part of the digital ideas. You know, they frame it similar to how the left frames vaccine inequity. They're saying essentially that the global south does not have what they deserve. And what they deserve is a way to pay for things digitally, which is such a weird thing to say that they need. But, you know, that benefits credit card companies and banks. It opens up markets. You know, it allows all these millions of people in Africa to start borrowing money from banks, being indebted to the banks, and relying on the banks for a number of economic and financial needs. And, you know, that's how it's all framed. That's how ID4D frames their ideas. They say, you know, these, you know, we have unbanked individuals, quote unquote. It's a new oppressed class of, you know, people who are not set up to the, you know, global banking system. And, you know, we must bring them banking. And these are people who, you know, are, some of them are struggling to get, you know, clean drinking water. They're struggling to get, you know, food. And instead, these people are saying they need access to the global monetary system. it does not benefit the people, that benefits the system. So in our piece, we kind of looked at how all of these projects, whether it's the World Economic Forum or the World Bank or USAID, the end goal is always to get them digital biometric IDs, whether it's, you know, vaccine is the lever, or, you know, there is, because they're unbanked, is the lever.
Well, it seems like now the lever, you know, the Trojan horse or whatever is being used to sort of foist this on society. You know, they've decided to use the vaccine passports more than anything else. And I think that's the only way they could really succeed in bringing the system to the global north, because previously all these pilot programs were that you're talking about were used on vulnerable populations. Some other examples that you didn't touch on, the World Food Program's, I think it's called Building Blocks with Syria. Syrian refugees living in Jordan having to scan their irises if they want access to humanitarian aid, being able to get access to food, essentially having to choose between access to food and surrendering their biometric data to this particular UN-backed biometric ID program. Another example being the iRespond, which is an ID 2020 member, their program for biometric digital identity from beginning with newborns among the stateless communities along the Myanmar-Thai border. And a couple, you know, I mean, and also some of the ones you talked about in India and Africa, you know, these are traditionally people without a lot of political agency. And this is where these groups tend to pilot these programs. In the global north, that isn't really the case. And they needed something, some sort of situation, I think, to be able to get a wide adoption of, you know, the sort of what is going to become is admitted to be a segue into a digital biometric ID system, which was previously attempted in the West, but with minimal success. A good example would be Tony Blair when he was prime minister of the UK, really trying to get this biometric digital ID thing rolling back, I think, in 2007. Of course, he's a big proponent for it now that he's runs his think tank and still influences British politics to a significant degree, but it didn't really catch on. There were concerns about it, right? So I think in the global north, you know, they needed some sort of situation to sort of bring about this change. And this is, you know, how they're planning to do it. Another thing I wanted to bring up, though, for people that are interested, there's a World Economic Forum. They call it an Insight Report. It's from September 2018, entitled Identity in a Digital World, a New Chapter in the Social Contract. And it's a pretty interesting piece because it pretty much, you know, years before COVID lays out what this is going to be for. The first paragraph of its executive summary reads, our identity is literally who we are. And as the digital technologies of the fourth industrial revolution advance, our identity is increasingly digital. This digital identity determines what products, services, and information we can access, or conversely, what is closed off to us. So essentially, they frame from the get-go, digital identity is something that the people that control the digital identity system will be able to use to control your access to products, services, and also information, which is pretty interesting, specifically in the context of how vaccine passports are being rolled out, and this whole digital identity thing, how it's also connected, if for people familiar with my work on the World Economic Forum partnership against cybercrime, how this is the foundation for laws being put out in the UK right now, like David's Law, the online safety law, and all of this stuff that want to link government-issued IDs, specifically digital IDs, to your social media accounts. If you go to page 10 of this 2018 Insight Report from the WEF, it actually says that that digital identity is the center, is the central point for your ability to access healthcare, electronic health records, vaccine registry, your ability to access food, to access financial services, to access social media platforms and the internet. to access travel and mobility, which of course is has been one of the main functionalities of the vaccine passports as they've been rolled out. Essentially, that's conditioning your access for particularly vulnerable people to things necessary to continue living to your participation in a biometric digital ID program. And then, of course, e-government and e-commerce services also tied into this as well. And you know, this is really the programs you're talking about in combination with the vaccine passport stuff. Really, this is where it all plans to go. It's very central to this fourth industrial revolution and the ambitions around that. And it's pretty far reaching and pretty far developed. And ID 2020 is a key part of this. But I think one of the reasons vaccination has been so tied into this is because of the role of the Gavi Vaccine Alliance as one of the founding members and one of the main participants in a lot of these pilot programs that have come out of that alliance since its launch, with the Gavi MasterCard Wellness Pass being one example. But talking about sort of the role of military contractors, as your piece does, the one I mentioned earlier about iRespond, which is an ID 2020 partner, their particular pilot program for refugee newborns on the Myanmar-Thai border that precedes COVID-19. The guy that's president and chairman of iRespond is pretty interesting, and I think gives a pretty clear, sort of like a microcosm, I guess you could say, of the forces that are involved in this push more broadly. So his name is Eric Rasmussen. He's president and chairman of the board of iRespond. Rasmussen is also a professor at Singularity University, which is all about artificial intelligence, the fourth industrial revolution. It's backed by Google. All the futurists, transhumanist, crazy people like Ray Kurzweil are there. But he's also chairman of the board at a global NGO called Instead that's all about humanitarian informatics around health and resource-poor economies. And they're partnered with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the U.S. CDC, Google, and UNICEF. Rasmussen is also CEO of a profit-for-purpose company called Infinitum Humanitarian Systems, which is similar to Instead, and it's focused on humanitarian informatics. But they work with USAID, the State Department, and U.S. military intelligence, and also the U.S. defense contractor and intelligence contractor Booz Allen Hamilton. So that's fun. And Rasmussen, before he had all of these fun roles, worked as the main investigator in humanitarian informatics for the U.S. military at DARPA, and had multiple wartime deployments to Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. So there seems to be a vein of the military running throughout all of this. And if you see the COVID-19 vaccination campaign as something meant to sort of bring about this digital ID system, which I think is a belief that you and I both share, it makes sort of their heavy involvement in the COVID-19 vaccination campaign through Warp Speed and other things a bit less surprising.
Yeah, the military's role in both the development of the vaccine and the rollout of vaccine passports should concern anyone who is wary of the U.S. military. In part two of our series on vaccine passports, we looked at MITRE, which is a nonprofit corporation almost led entirely by military intelligence professionals and sustained with sizable contracts with the Department of Defense, the FBI, the national security sector. And they have been responsible for some of the most invasive surveillance technology in use by U.S. spy agencies today. Its products include a system built for the FBI, which captures individuals' fingerprints from images posted on social media sites. Mm-hmm. So they are just, you know, neck deep in surveillance tools, and they are, you know, playing a critical role in the rollout of vaccine passports in the U.S. through the Vaccine Credential Initiative. So And they're also, partnered with Palantir and all these other good, CIA-linked military intelligence companies.
Yeah, that's through the what's it called? The CHC COVID-19 Healthcare Coalition or something. That's like MITRE's program, and Palantir's a member of that. Google, all the big Silicon Valley companies, a bunch of health insurance companies, several universities in the US, a bunch of different organizations, and it's all about harnessing data. And Palantir, of course, which is one of the most, you probably can't be more connected to the CIA than Palantir, from their origins, onward. They've really been the storing most of the COVID-19 health data for HHS in the US, but also the NHS in the UK, which is pretty interesting. So a lot of very shady entities involved there. And of course, Palantir has a very major role in surveillance. I mean, it's a contractor to all 17, or I guess it's 18 now, US intelligence agencies, and is intimately involved in some rather suspect surveillance stuff that they do. And that's pretty evident by the fact that you can label people in the Palantir system with all these different types of labels, but one of the labels is subversives. So that implies good things happen there, doesn't it? All of this takes on a much more, I guess, it is much more concerning when you consider that this whole system, that these entities like Palantir and MITRE and all of this, are helping build, is going to condition your ability to access essential services or not. And the way this is played out, as you point out in your article, with very increasingly vulnerable people being deprived of their food and actually starving to death, as a consequence of the functioning, or rather malfunctioning, of these systems, that certainly does not bode well, at the very least at all. The fact that they're so intent, despite the lack of logical reasoning behind it, in terms of, we have to vaccinate the whole African continent, and these overtures that are basically implying that the US is going to try and send the US military into Africa to get, needles and arms and all of this stuff. It definitely starts to look pretty nasty. As you try and step out and see sort of the bigger picture of what's going on here. This is part of a broader push, even beyond the vaccines and digital ID, sort of some stuff that I've covered recently with natural asset corporations and this global financial alliance for net zero and stuff like this, that is all focused on reimagining the IMF and the World Bank and all of these groups to sort of force the developing world to adopt certain policies or receive certain investments that are deemed friendly to the fourth industrial revolution agenda, but specifically certain billionaires and certain, multi-million, multi-billion dollar private banks and hedge funds and equity firms and stuff. There's a lot going on here, and it's really disappointing to see progressives, the bigger name progressives, I guess you could say, a lot of them sort of asleep at the wheel when it comes to this stuff. But, when I look at people like, I don't know, like Noam Chomsky, his interview with Primo Nuttmeg saying some really crazy stuff about the unvaccinated, but also his track record with topics such as like 9/11, the 2008 financial crisis, the John F. Kennedy assassination, even his take on the Jeffrey Epstein scandal and all of this stuff. It makes you wonder how many of these bigger quote unquote progressive names are gatekeepers or just people who are afraid. But regardless, the people that are rubber stamping this and framing what these ulterior agendas sort of as, altruistic and progressive and all of this stuff are actually, it seems to me, causing a lot more damage than I think they realize, because fundamentally a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about today seems to point to a very dark imperialist agenda for the developing world, specifically Africa. And it's just not being seen for what it is by people that are normally quite good at that.
Of course. I mean, when you see, the military intelligence apparatus, getting behind everyone, getting these digital IDs, if the first thing into your head isn't surveillance and control, then, your head's not in the right place. It's definitely not public health. That's, that's for certain. And when you see who's behind, even Warp Speed was, the vaccine itself was a, military project. And then the vaccine passports, another military project. And it's very rarely that the military does anything for public health. And I just want to go back to one thing very quickly. When we were talking about ID 2020, Elizabeth Reneris, she was on the board of ID 2020, and she's the founding director of Notre Dame's IBM Technology Ethics Lab.
Well, that sounds like a fun place.
It sounds like a fun place. But she actually resigned from ID 2020. And she resigned citing, privacy concerns. And she warned that as dominant technology, this is at a, she warned the, this is at a Senate hearing. She warned that as dominant technology and surveillance companies pursue new revenue streams in healthcare and financial services, privately owned and operated ID systems with profit maximizing business models threaten privacy, security, and other fundamental rights of individuals and communities. So this is someone who worked for ID 2020, and I guess she was maybe too positive in the beginning. She thought they were going to maybe do something. I don't know what her initial theory about ID 2020 was, but she stepped down citing privacy concerns and had that to say. So I think that's very telling that, she left a profitable position like that to say that.
ID 2020 from the very beginning had some shady stuff about it, in my opinion. but one thing about it that I think deserves a lot more coverage is this presentation that was given at their inaugural summit that was hosted at the UN, I guess back when they formally launched in like 2016. And essentially, it's this lady named Monique Morrow and some other people on her her particular team that put this presentation together. And they basically link digital identity, sort of as the same way that World Economic Forum report I mentioned earlier sort of lays it all out, all these different services you'll be able to access with digital ID at the center. But they equate digital ID at the center with something they call freedom as a service, like a rebranding of freedom, not really as a human right, but freedom as a service. Now, and that, or at least in this system, would be that your ability to enjoy or participate, have certain freedoms is now a service and not like a guaranteed right, either granted to you by a constitution or a religious, worldview or whatever. It's not a guaranteed thing. It's now a service that you have to meet the necessary requirements to be able to enjoy that service. I mean, that is like a huge shift in human in governance, in human society, that has been promoted by this group from the very beginning. But I think it's very illuminating, especially with what we're seeing now, and that there's a lot more awareness and a lot more research having been done on these particular groups. It's pretty clear that that's really where this is ultimately going. And like that WEF report says, it's about what you'll be able to access and what you won't be able to access. And who determines if you have the quote unquote freedom to access certain pieces of information or certain services or certain places? The people that run these systems and their public-private partnerships, developed by some of these private companies or like SimPrints, iRespond, Trust Stamp are some of the ones that are teamed up here. But also in coordination with these military intelligence contractors we've been talking about, and also the state itself. So, it's a really complicated situation, which is just ripe for tyranny, for lack of a better word. I mean, it's just really over the top and increasingly dangerous. And my concern is that we are really sleepwalking into this. So, I don't know how many of the progressive-leaning vaccine inequity, the promoters of that inequity narrative, probably not many of them, listen to this podcast. But I think, you know, maybe some people who engage with them do. And I think, you know, our best bet really is to sort of highlight some of the things we've been talking about, particularly in the latter segment of the, of this podcast, about the digital ID push and some of these more, you know, this apparent push from people like, you know, Andy Slavitt and some of the stuff that's emerging out of the Omicron variant narrative that someone needs to be sent to put needles in arms in Africa that aren't from Africa. You know, there's definitely, we need to encourage these people, at least, because there have to be some honest actors in there. They can't, you know, all be gatekeepers. Some people make that argument. But I think we definitely need to start pushing them to re-examine the issue.
Yeah, definitely. When you see, you know, on Twitter, all of these, you know, blue check people who have, you know, consistently been on the right side of, you know, the war in Syria, the war in Iraq, you know, different pushes to leave Afghanistan. They've always supported it. And then when it comes to this, they're like, send in the troops. So, you know, eventually, and it can't be that hard to make them see how, you know, something like sending in the troops or, you know, advocating something in America for a country that is thousands of miles away in Africa or in Latin America, or in, you know, South Asia is not, you know, it's not a good look for an anti-imperialist, and it's also probably not the correct take.
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more with that. Obviously, that should be pretty clear given what you and I have been discussing today. But for people that aren't familiar with Jeremy's work, I really consider, I would ask you to consider following him on Twitter and social media, because he has provided a lot of really great pushback to these arguments as they have come out. And a lot of other really good information as it relates to a lot of things going on right now, whether it's digital IDs or, you know, aspects of the COVID-19 vaccine rollout. So, Jeremy, for those that have been listening and may not have been familiar with your work, how can people follow you and support you?
I would just ask that you follow me on Twitter at Wilfredo Jeremy. And if you're looking how to spell that, I'm sure it'll be in the podcast information.
Yes, it will. All right. So thanks so much, Jeremy, for your time and for talking about these important issues that, well, may get us some hate mail. But at this point, it's really unavoidable to talk about, you know, some of these issues that are ongoing and to bring some of this information to light, because a lot of stuff that we've covered today, specifically this vaccine equity or versus inequity discussion, you know, has really just been pretty absent. More often than not. So I think this is pretty vital information. So for those that are, you know, that are listening that feel that way, I would encourage you to share this podcast around once it becomes publicly available, because for people that are familiar with the podcast, you probably know that it's paywalled for the first couple of days on Rockfin and also available to unlimited Hangout members. And after that is available on pretty much every podcasting app. Also, as I mentioned, my previous episode with Dr. Meryl Nass, this is probably going to be my last podcast because I am going to be going on maternity leave. I am going to be having a little person any day now, so I will not be able to do a regular podcast for at least a period of time. If you are on the Unlimited Hangout mailing list, you will be informed when that changes. And so I would encourage people listening that would like information as to when maternity leave will be concluding for me and things like that, please go to unlimitedhangout.com and sign up for our mailing list. Yeah, so that's it for today. Thanks to everyone for listening, and a special thank you to people who support the podcast, and catch you in the next episode. Thanks, everyone.